Welcome to our fourth talk on our Orthodox Survival Series. As you saw in the email this week, this talk is going to be quite a bit different from the past two that we've given, right? So the past two have been very theoretical. They've gone kind of in-depth into the intellectual or anti-intellectual nature of everything going on around us. And today's going to be much, much more practical. We're going to go just straight to, okay, how do we apply this? So, to make things a little bit more digestible of what we talked about the past couple weeks, I want to share some statistics with you, and then talk about why this is important for us to know, but also why it may not help that much. So, 2018 is the last year I could find where the FBI gave statistics on homicide and crime. In 2018, these were their statistics. White murder victims, the number of white murder victims by white offenders, so white people killing white people, numbered in that year, pretty shocking, 2,677. It's a lot. White murder victims by black offenders, so a black person killing a white person, numbered 514. The black murder victims by white offenders, so white people killing black people, 234. So the other way is 514, now it's 234, and then black murder victims by black offenders. Black people killing other black people, 2,600. That's just 77 less than white people killing white people, and because the population of black Americans is so much smaller than white Americans, it shows you that the percentage of black people killing black people is much, much higher. In 2019, which is obviously the last full year that we had statistics for it, how many unarmed black men were killed by police? Anybody know?
Nine.
And in each case, they're clearly justified when looking at the facts of the case. If you look at the facts of the case and what was happening, they were justified. And most people would agree so. Now, there were two really thorough studies done. There have been some minor ones done, but two main thorough studies done in the past 5 years that looked into systemic racism in the police in the United States. One in particular is very interesting because it was done by a black Harvard professor who sought to prove the systemically racist nature of American policing. You know what they showed? The opposite. Both studies showed that there is no systemic racism in American policing. The Harvard professor was shocked to find this. And it showed that in many cases, officers are actually more reluctant to use deadly force on black suspects because of the fear of being called racist. Now, some statistics seem to show that there is a higher percentage of police brutality or aggression towards black suspects, but not when you take into account, and incarceration as well, not when you take into account the rate of crime, both geographically and demographically. When you take this into account, it all evens out. It shows that there's not a systemic racism problem in American policing. Does it mean that an individual cop can't be racist? Of course he can. But is it systemic? The statistics say no. Now, why in the world am I talking about this? Why are we talking about this at all? Why are the riots going on right now? We're told that there's systemic racism. If you look at the statistics, you find out, no, there's actually not systemic racism in policing, and there's a much, much bigger problem in the civilian population. That's where the real problems come about. And black families have the biggest problem when it comes to black-on-black crime and with fatherless households. These are the biggest problems. So the reason I present all this is because if all of this is true, and somebody could argue with me on these facts, but I've looked at them. I've seen some of the studies that were critical of these policing studies, especially the Harvard one, and I found the criticisms to be pretty weak, not very accurate. But let's say everything I just said could be proven to be true. When you present this to somebody who's in that mindset, does it change their mind? Do they sit there and have a light bulb go on and they go, huh, maybe I shouldn't be out there riding. Maybe there are things I should be more concerned about. Does that happen very often? No. No, it does not. Why? Well, we spent 2 weeks talking about this, right? We had 2 lectures talking about the nature of ideology. Right? So let's recap the purpose of the last two lectures. The last two lectures were meant to help you understand what ideology is, why ideology is dangerous, and to understand the ideology that surrounds us today. And remember what we said about ideology. When you're stuck in ideology, when you become an ideologue, ideology is truth. Outside facts and statistics aren't truth because we have the truth because we feel it. So they become a threat. And by presenting a statistic that shows me that my view is wrong, you're actually attacking me. And I take it personally, and that's why I get emotional and angry at you. That's why this happens. So the reason I present all of this, and again, if you want to disagree with me about the statistics, I don't care. That's not the point of this. The point is simply to say that even when you present these statistics, some people are so dug into their ideology, it literally doesn't matter. Facts, statistics don't matter. And we've talked a lot about why. So the question for today is, if that's the case, how do we talk about these things? Is it possible to have a real conversation with an ideologue? And more importantly than talking about everything going on in the world, how do we talk about our faith? When do we speak up? When do we remain silent? How do we gauge different situations and know how to approach them? And what is our responsibility towards others in terms of our faith and when facing Christ at the judgment seat? These are the questions we're going to look at today. We've done all the theory about what's going on. Now the question is, how do we talk about this with people who really disagree with us? And mainly, how do we talk about our faith? So this talk is entitled, How To and How Not to Share Your Faith. A lot will deal with how to discuss these things with argumentative people. But keep in mind that arguing about our faith is not the goal. That's not the main thing we're talking about today. We have to make sure that the discussion is worthwhile in the first place. The scriptures have a lot to say, by the way, about how to talk with people about God. If you look up, just Google, like, what do the scriptures say about arguing? You'll come up with nearly 100 verses that talk about this. The one I want to start with today is Titus 3:9. But avoid foolish controversies, genealogies, dissensions, and quarrels about the law, for they are unprofitable and worthless. It doesn't just have to be about the law. If we're going to talk about our faith, we need to make sure that it's not a foolish controversy, that we're not talking about foolish dissensions and quarrels. Keep in mind, we should want to share our faith. We should have a burning desire to share our faith. And one of the things I've said about the scriptures before is, can you imagine if you woke up one morning and as you walk to your table for breakfast, suddenly there's a flash of light. Boom! And right on the table is a letter. And it's written to you by Christ himself. And you read this letter. You're going to hold this letter dear. But you're not just going to hold it dear. You are going to want to share this letter with absolutely everybody who you get into contact with. Everyone you meet. I had this experience, flash of light. Beautiful fragrance filled the room. I heard the voice of Christ saying, this is my letter to you. Here it is. Let me read it to you. And you'd want to read it to everybody. You'd want to read that letter every day. You'd wake up every single morning and say, the first thing I want to do is read my letter from Christ. But we have the scriptures. God's love letter to us. Do we yearn to read it every day, the Bible? Do we have this burning desire to read the scriptures? Do we think it's any less personal just because it's not personalized towards us? It is. It's written to everybody. So why don't we have that yearning desire? And why don't we have this fiery desire to share our faith with others? There's a lot of reasons for that. But rather than examining it, let's just say we should have a burning desire to share our faith. However, as Orthodox Christians, we recognize that we don't necessarily do this like everybody else. We're not going to go stand on the street corner with a bullhorn. We're not going to necessarily go door to door. In my last parish, they wanted to do that. They wanted to go door to door to all our neighbors and tell them about Orthodoxy. And I was talking to another priest about this. I said, this isn't really the way Orthodoxy has ever done it. And he goes, yeah, you don't go door to door selling convertibles. You sell Girl Scout cookies. His point was, if our theology was really simple and could be wrapped up in one or two sentences, Believe in Jesus and accept him as your Lord and Savior, and you'll be saved. There, that's basically the whole basis of my whole entire faith. There's a Girl Scout cookie. I can sell that to you. But orthodoxy is so rich. It's so ornate. There's so much depth. And if I make a statement like that, like, this is how you're saved, you have to go and explain every single word. This is why when the fathers write about things, they don't write simple answers. If you've ever noticed that, you can ask the fathers of the church a yes or no question. And rather than spending like one paragraph being like, here's your question, here's your answer. Your answer is yes, and this is why. There you go. Have fun. They spend like 18, 20, 30, 40 pages. Why? Because rather than just answer your question, which is easy to do, they want to take you around the whole thing and get you to see it from a different perspective. And they want to suck you into the life of the faith. They want to say, yeah, okay, I can answer this question, but in answering this, there's a whole life that we need to understand. This is why people say that if you can answer a question in 1 to 2 sentences, the Orthodox will always answer it in 40 sentences. Why? Because there's a depth there that we need to plumb. And that's more beneficial than the simple yes or no answer. It's much more beneficial. So we should have a burning desire to share our faith, but we need to know how to do it properly. We'll talk a little bit about that today, but mainly we're talking about how to engage the culture with it. How to engage the culture is the most important thing. So first, let's talk about what makes talking about our faith difficult. Because it is. It's tough, right? Anybody had that experience where somebody challenges your faith and you immediately get a knot in your stomach? Why? Why does it happen? There's fear. We have a fear when it comes to presenting our faith. And I think that fear comes mainly from two places. The first, we fear our own limits of knowledge. We feel like we really don't know our faith very well. By the way, this something says something about our spiritual life. If this happens to us and we go, boy, I'm really afraid here because I don't know my faith very well, but then we don't use that to motivate ourselves to go learn more, that's a problem. That shows a problem. We don't have that burning love for Christ. When we notice a lack in our knowledge, when we notice some holes in what we know and don't know, or holes in what we know, why is it that we don't go, my goodness, I want to learn about this, and we go to the fathers, we search them out, and we talk to our priests and things like that? Why don't we do that? We should have this. This is an opportunity. We need to look at it that way. But the fact is that we really don't know our faith very well. And we aren't, this is more important, many of us are not very confident in our faith. We need to have confidence in our faith. If you are confident in your faith because you're living the spiritual life, even the things you don't know don't become a big deal. Because you say, well, by experience, I know this is true. Even if I don't know the exact answer to this particular question, I know from experience this is true. There's been enough to show me that this is true. And we don't worry so much because we have the humility to say, well, I'm not really sure I know the answer to that question, but I'll look it up for you. No big deal. It's no big deal doing that. We fear not being able to answer other people's points and criticisms. Sometimes this just comes, by the way, with experience. The more conversations you have, the more you start to anticipate people's questions. As a priest, it's very rare that I hear a question I haven't heard before. And so I've learned the answers, and now they're just kind of, you know, stockpiled up, and it's just like looking through the file, like, Father, what about, hold on, you can go to the right file, pull it out, here's your answer. That can be dangerous too, by the way, because then we can sound robotic. The faith is living. So I'm constantly adding to this, and I'm constantly changing the way we talk about these things. That's why you can listen to 2 years catechism classes, and the lectures on the same things don't sound anything alike. Because we're constantly going deeper and deeper into our faith. That's also why, by the way, when you listen to the catechism courses, and even if you've been baptized, you should listen to them. If you listen to the same course once a year for 5 or 10 years in a row, you'll get something different out of it every time. Because where you are changes how you hear things and how you understand them. So, we're afraid of the limits of our own knowledge. Secondly, there may be consequences to our discussion. There are consequences to our words. There may be family issues that are exacerbated. I know none of you have that problem at all, right? None of you have non-Orthodox family members who might fight you on things or disagree with you or get upset with you. None of you have. Almost every single one of you has that. Like, every person in this room has that. There may be consequences at work if we bring up our faith. We're going to talk about how to deal with that in today's lecture. So tonight we're going to talk about how to approach conversations, both about the world around us, but mainly about our faith. And we'll talk about how to approach these conversations in the face of both of these fears, our lack of knowledge and the consequences that could happen. Most of what we say tonight will be helpful for both, both when talking about our faith and when talking about the ideological arguments that surround us today. Most of it'll be related to both, but if it's only related to one, you'll be able to tell. And I want to note in this, as we get into this, the place of logic, because this is one place that trips a lot of people up with orthodoxy. They hear that orthodoxy is mostly about experience, right? This is what happened in the West. The West spent way too much time standing back from the mystery of God and examining it and using logic to try to figure it out. It's like Thomas Aquinas' big approach. Damon loves that approach. It's his favorite thing in the world. It's what he used to be involved in. And he's talked to me. Hopefully I can use it as an example. But he's talked about how entering the depths of prayer made his faith grow so much more. And it began to become more real by just doing it and entering the mystery. This is the Orthodox approach. We go, I'm not going to be able to explain this very well, so I'm just going to step right into the mystery. But does that mean that we have no place for logic and no place for reason? Of course not. In fact, St. Gregory Palamas wrote an entire book against the Roman Catholic doctrine of the filioque, the word they added to the creed, which means and the Son. Their belief that the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and the Son, rather than from the Father through the Son, which is the Orthodox belief. And you know what St. Gregory Palamas' main criticism is that he says again and again? He says, the Latins have come up with a false doctrine because they are against true logic. They're against true logic. But here's the thing about Orthodox logic. Orthodox logic begins with the experience and then uses the words. It's important that we do it that way, because if we do it the other way, you can use logic to say some pretty ridiculous things. And because we all have worldviews, we talked about this on the second lecture. Because we all have worldviews, you can't escape that. The very way that you view the world changes the way that you use and understand logic. So we're constantly changing our minds by changing our hearts. We want the experience first. And when I say experience, I don't mean necessarily that you have to have this great experience of the saints and that you have to have seen the uncreated light and Christ appeared to you and the Theotokos appeared to you and you hear the voice of the saints. In fact, if that's happening, come and talk to me and we'll see what's going on, because it may not be a good thing. But really what it means is you're living the life of repentance. And you may not see the change happening. You may say, boy, I just feel like I'm going through the motions. I don't really see a change in me. But you've heard me say this before. Look at yourself today compared to 6 months ago or 1 year ago. The one sign that I know that I'm at least growing a little bit in the faith is that I can look at things that I said and did a year ago and be like, idiot. At the time, I thought I was really smart and wise. But now I can look back and go, man, I was an idiot. And after a while, I realized, well, wait a minute. If I think I'm an idiot a year ago, based on what I understand now, does that mean in a year I'm going to think what I'm doing and saying today makes me an idiot? Yeah, probably. Probably. I'm going to look back at these lectures and be like, don't listen to that guy. That was the old me. I've grown. I'm smarter now. This is how we know we're growing. Can I tell you day to day that I'm experiencing that? No. But through prayer, fasting, repentance, this is what happens. Is little by little we change. So there is a place for logic. We'll talk about that today. So if you have things to write, I should have told everybody this is the one to write things down on, because there's a lot of details to remember. If you don't worry. We're recording it right now. You can listen to it later, but we're going to really jump into this. There's going to be a lot to remember. So, first item, we need to talk about the disposition we must have when we discuss our faith. What's the disposition? Before anything else, this is the most important thing. And I will tell you that people's lives have been changed. People who are completely against the faith have become some of the most faithful Orthodox Christians you've ever seen, because they came into contact with somebody who lived a holy life and had humility and love, but couldn't explain a darn thing about their faith. The explanation comes second. So we're going to start with a big warning. Take care of your pride. Every day be working on your pride. This is not about, when you have a discussion about the faith, this is not about you being right. You may have come into this thinking, well, orthodoxy is the truth, and therefore this is about being right. No, ultimately this is not what it's about. It's not about being right. We're going to talk about why in a little bit. You need, no matter how ideological, no matter how angry, no matter how critical, no matter how insulting the person standing next to you is, you need to be able to see Christ within them. It's very important to start there. You need to have the humility to recognize that you need truth just as much as the person you're speaking to. You may sit there and say, well, I'm already an Orthodox Christian. They need it more than I do because they don't believe in this. Yeah, but you have the fullness of the faith. How much are you living it? In a way, we're worse off. The condemnation is greater for us. We need Christ just as much as they do. We also need to make sure we avoid looking like a hypocrite. I'm going to tell you about Christ and how much we need Christ and how great Christ is by yelling at you and insulting you. Wow, good example. Not going to work too much. We need the peace of heart. We need to live it first. This means a very simple thing, practically. We need to use a calm voice. If we notice our voice heightening, it probably means that we're speaking from our passions, not from the peace and humility that Christ is supposed to give us. By the way, you know what happens when you raise your voice. What happens to the person you're talking to? They raise their voice. So you have to beat them. So you raise your voice, and they raise their voice. It goes up and up and up. And if you've never had this experience, try it when you're disciplining your kids. Please don't do that. Why? Don't you say why to me? Why? Why are you yelling at me? Go to your room! I don't want to go to my room! And it goes higher and higher and higher. I almost made myself pass out by doing that right now. I just got lightheaded. When you raise, they match. When they match, you raise again. Whereas if you use a calmer voice, have you ever had the experience? I don't know if you've done this. When somebody comes to you and they're upset. I'm really upset. I'm so mad at you because blah, 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 blah. My goodness. You do seem upset. Can we sit down and talk about it? Just by having that calm voice, sometimes it starts to lower them. It may take a little while, but you get there. Be willing to listen. To a point. Our disposition needs to be one where we're willing to listen. And we're martyric in our listening. We shut off the voice within our heads and we really listen. That's the martyrdom. We have to kill that voice in our heads. We're going to talk about when to walk away and when to stop listening later. But to a point, we have to be willing to really listen. And don't go on the attack. It's not the way to go. You can't have the right disposition if you go on the attack. I've spent a lot of time the past 2 weeks attacking the ideology around us. Is that the way I'd approach it if I had somebody in that ideology sitting right next to me having a discussion? No. I'm having it because I want to warn you about what's happening. I want you to understand what's happening around us. But is this what you throw at people? It's not going to work too well. Because the more they feel accused, the more they're going to get defensive. It's that dog that rabid dog in the corner thing. Proverbs 15:1. I told you scriptures are full of great advice on this. 15:1 Proverbs. A soft answer turns away wrath. But a harsh word stirs up anger. It's a beautiful line. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Is there a time and a place for harsh words? Christ certainly thought so. But most of the time, he had a pretty soft approach with people, at least at first. So if your disposition is so important, guess where the worst place in the world is to have discussions about these things is. What's the worst place in the world? The internet. Can they see you on the internet? No. Do they know your disposition? No. Can they hear the tone of your voice? No. And people read a heightened voice when there isn't one. I remember on Facebook when I used to have these discussions, arguments, I used to put things in all caps because Facebook doesn't allow you to italicize. And people see all caps and they think that you're yelling. So I had one guy go, why are you yelling? And I'm like, I'm not yelling. I'm just trying to emphasize this word. And then I went, oh, they're not reading it the way that I'm writing it. Duh. Internet's not a good place to have these discussions. Simply put, three words, don't do it. Don't try to have these discussions on the internet. And this also means that, yes, we should try to learn our faith. If we have that fear, we should try to learn our faith and we should be confident enough in our faith, which means we're constantly learning. You're not going to be perfectly confident. I still have, every now and then, it doesn't happen very often. Like I said, I get the same questions again and again, but every now and then, someone will ask me a question. I go, huh, I've never thought about that. I really don't know. I'll look it up for you. You have to be willing to say it. It's no big deal. Don't be afraid, in other words, to say, I don't know, or I need to look it up. Not a big deal. Don't be afraid. And as you talk more, like I said, you'll see patterns in people's arguments and their viewpoints, and you'll learn how to address those things. You'll have them all right there in your quiver. You'll be ready to take out that arrow and say, here's the answer to that one. Your experience of faith, by the way, is one of your most powerful weapons. And I say that because if you get knocked into a corner logically and you just don't know some of the facts, somebody says, well, what about in church history? When this happened, they bring up some like esoteric thing that no one's ever heard of unless you've read this like outdated textbook from the 1950s and only they have a copy and no one else in the world has one. Like, people do this type of thing. Sit there and say, you know, I've never heard of that. I'm not really sure. I'll have to look it up. By the way, just because we're Orthodox Christians doesn't mean everything Orthodox people do is right. Just because there's problems in the church doesn't mean it's wrong. Have you ever read the book of Acts? There were problems right from the start with the apostles. But I can tell you from my experience, I can say, you know, I'm not really sure the answer to that, but I can tell you from my own prayer life what it's like being an Orthodox Christian and what this faith has done in my life. It's okay to use that. In fact, it's really effective with some people. Christianity first spread, by the way, less by miracles and more by the consistent lives of humble love and service. During the pagan era, there are many miracles that you hear about them in the lives of saints almost every day, especially from the martyrs. But that's not the main way the faith spread. The main way the faith spread, people saw Christians in humble service and loving those who hated them. That's the main way the faith spread. In fact, some of our greatest saints became Christians because of this. St. Pachomius, one of the greatest desert fathers. He had thousands. He began what we call cenobitic monasticism. He had thousands and thousands of monks under his care when he died. He became a Christian because he was in prison. And Christians came to visit him. And he was shocked at their love. And he said, any faith that could make you this loving, I want to know about. That's what made him a Christian. It wasn't miracles. So again, you don't need to be a great faith who's had multiple visions. You need to have humble love. Next, B, tools for you to learn and practice. There are certain little things that you need to learn how to do, and this again is where note-taking would be really helpful, otherwise just store it all in your memory. Number one, before you get into a conversation about the faith, you hear me say this all the time, what's the best question to ask first? Do you really want to know? Do you really want to have this conversation? Because when somebody comes at you aggressively, I can't believe you believe this, how could you believe this? Do you really want to know? Do you actually want to hear my answer, or do you just want to yell at me? Often that alone will kind of defuse them a little bit. It'll break that tension. They'll go, oh, well, I guess I do really want to know. And suddenly you've entered a conversation rather than an argument. Ask people, do you really want to talk about this? Do you want to hear my view on this? Sometimes you have to prepare them, especially if it's a view about the ideology around us. You have to prepare them and say, you know, you may not want to hear this yet. Are you sure you want to hear my opinion about this? Next, assume that you don't understand their terms, their verbiage. In other words, constantly ask, what do you mean by that? If you're going to have a real conversation, it's way too easy to talk past one another. So you need to make sure you understand what they're actually saying. So ask them, what do you mean by that? And along the same lines, gather information. If they feel listened to, there's a good chance they'll actually listen to you when you speak. But if you're just talking back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, guess what? You're thinking of your response before they finished, and they're thinking of their response before you finished. You're not really listening. So practice listening first. And use this approach where you gather information. Tell me more about that. I don't really understand what you meant when you said this. Can you explain it more to me? It's really important to do that because you want to understand their position before you can respond. We're going to talk a lot about this in a minute. Look for hidden premises in order to question those premises. They're presuppositions. I'll give you an example. This is a real conversation that happened. Somebody said, you know, I've looked into Christianity and I found so many things that don't make sense about it. I really don't want to look into it anymore. Are there hidden presuppositions in that statement? Here's a few of them. Number one, you've looked into Christianity. Have you looked into all Christianity? There's some Christianity I've looked into that I don't want anything to do with. Have you looked into all Christianity? Another presupposition in there. Does not making sense equal wrong? Maybe you didn't understand it well. Maybe it didn't make sense to you because it wasn't explained very well. Not making sense doesn't necessarily mean wrong. Another hidden presupposition. I've looked into Christianity. Was looking into it an honest search? Did you search honestly? Or was it simply this thing where you were looking for what was wrong with it to begin with, and you didn't give it an honest search? You know what a really good response this would be? I've looked into Christianity and I found so many things that don't make sense. I want nothing to do with it. Tell me about your experience looking into Christianity. What happened? Find out a little more information. What does this person understand Christianity to be? Did he actually live it, or did he just look at it intellectually? What happened to him if he did actually try to live by it? Let's say he really tried to live it. What happened? What was your experience? How did you try to live it? You may find out that his experience is so far from the Orthodox understanding that he's just got the wrong idea of what Christianity is. Those are just a few of the presuppositions in that statement. So look for those. Find out, what are they actually saying? What's behind the statement? Again, we're going to talk more about that in a little bit. Restate things to make sure you've got it right. So what you're saying is, that way they feel heard, but also you can make sure your understanding is right, because you may find out that what you heard is not at all what they were trying to say. Happens all the time. By the way, this is good advice for marriage. Really good advice for marriage. We're going to talk about looking for examples that contradict their premises in a minute, because there's a right way to do that. Try to be well informed. If you aren't, that's okay. Just know what you're approaching. There are times when conversations should occur. Or shouldn't occur. There are times when conversations shouldn't occur. We're going to talk about that. But if the conversation should occur, do you know what we're told in scriptures about this? 1 Peter 3:15. Always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who calls you to account for the hope that is in you. Yet, do it with gentleness and reverence. So we should know these things, but the reality is some topics take a lot of research. Most people, if you're going to talk about like Black Lives Matter, most people don't have the statistics in their pocket ready to go. Most people don't. But at least when you're talking about your faith, be prepared. Be prepared to give a defense of the hope that's in you. Be prepared to talk about why you really believe this. Why is an important question, and it's the most important one. You need to be able to answer why. Why do you believe in the Orthodox faith? Why do you do what you do? We're going to talk about that in a little bit as well. Okay, C. Traps to watch out for when you talk. Firstly, you need to know a little bit about logic and logical fallacies. The reality is as a culture, we are no longer taught how to think. Jonah, this isn't the time I'm going to call on you yet, but I'm going to call on you anyway. What percentage of your students come in with the ability to think well, would you say?
Very minuscule.
The percentage is very minuscule. That's very precise. Thank you. He doesn't have a statistic in his back pocket. Good. See, you can say that. Most of us don't know. One of the things I do recommend, I know I've been telling you a lot of stuff to study. I'm sure you were happy when I pulled out my table today and you only saw my water bottle and no stack of books, because you've had that the past 2 weeks. But there's one thing I'd ask you to look up. I think it's important to start learning this and study it a little bit. You should study logical fallacies. You should be able to spot them and point them out. It's really important to be able to do that. There's a book I found that I thought, it's about 86 pages. It's pretty good, and it just tells you what the logical fallacies are and gives you examples. I don't know if you, do you know of any, Jonah, that are really good?
So there's one by Wesson, last name Wesson, called Handbook for Arguments.
Handbook for Arguments, I came across that one. That's by Wesson, but that one's a little bit longer, right?
Yeah, maybe.
I might have mixed it up with another one. I was looking for a short one. There's one I found that it's by a guy named Jacob Van Vliet. Not Van Fleet. Van Vliet, V-L-E-E-T, which is a tongue twister of a name. Jacob Van Vliet. It's called Informal Logical Fallacies, A Brief Guide. I skimmed through it today. I thought it was pretty good. It's helpful. Again, it's not necessary, but it is good to know a bit about logical fallacies because people use them all the time. However, I have a warning with this. Anybody know what my warning is with learning about logic and logical fallacies? It's going to drive you nuts. You are going to go absolutely crazy. Every time you hear politicians speak, every time you see people argue things online, in fact, every conversation you get into, you are going to go nuts and you're going to realize that like people use logical fallacies constantly. Just constantly. So this is where you have to really watch out for your pride. Don't think, because I know it's a logical fallacy, you don't know logic at all. Just get rid of that. Just humble yourself. Most people don't learn this. I took a class in college on logical fallacies, one of the greatest courses I ever took. I came out hearing things in a very different way. And I learned how to analyze arguments. Again, this isn't for everybody. I'm not saying everybody has to do this. I'm saying it's really beneficial to do this. So what's the worst that happens? You spend a couple weeks reading these books and studying a little bit, and yeah, you might end up a little bit better at this type of thing. But you got to watch out for the traps. The traps happen in logical fallacies. Some of the most common traps, false dilemmas. Beware of false options. We see that today, right? Either we've been talking about Black Lives Matter, right? Either you support Black Lives Matter or you're a racist. Are those really the only two options? Probably not. But we hear this all the time. Do you support Israel or Palestine? Are those the only two options? Maybe I really don't support either fully. Maybe I see problems on both sides. Maybe my view is a little bit more nuanced. False options are all over the place. You have to watch out for those. Red herrings. People love to use red herrings. What's a red herring? A red herring is essentially just that somebody brings up a point that you weren't even talking about, and it becomes a distraction. People do this all the time. This is one of the main ways that people argue today. You say something, you go, yeah, but what about this? Well, wait a minute, that's what we weren't talking about, that. That may be related, but it's not about the main point. Let's talk about the main point first. We're talking about a very specific thing. You don't necessarily, by the way, need to point out every time somebody gets distracted. You just need to redirect them. There's somebody who does this really well. I'll talk about that at the end. Remind me. There's somebody whose videos I think are really helpful with this, and they show you how to do it. Because people will go on these long rants about different things, and they'll go way off topic, and you'll go, well, wait a minute. Let's return back to the question I actually asked to begin with. You have to kind of redirect people. Non sequiturs. Does not follow. These happen all the time. The main one that happens today, that disparity, which means an inequity between two groups, equals discrimination. Just because there's a disparity in something doesn't mean somebody was actively discriminated against. Sometimes there's disparities for different reasons. Thomas Sowell, you know, you've heard that name 100 times. I have to spring it up one more time. He has a whole book titled this. I think it's called Disparities in Discrimination or something like that. He has a whole book about this very topic. That just because you see a difference in demographic, like you know, the average black income today is this, and the average black-white income is this, and that's why it proves that America's racist. Well, no, it doesn't prove that. There may be a different reason for that. Discriminations and disparities, I think is what it is, or disparities and discrimination. But if you type in those words in Thomas Sowell, S-O-W-E-L-L, you'll find it. Appeals from or appeals to authority is a big one. Huge one, you see it all the time. Oh, that's your opinion? Well, this Harvard economist says this. Are you telling me that you're smarter than the Harvard economist? I'm not saying I'm smarter, but Harvard economists have been wrong a lot. And by the way, just because you say that this expert says this, I can find another expert who says the exact opposite. So why is your expert right and my expert wrong? And people use that all the time. What we really want to do is we want to be able to find those hidden, we talked about finding those hidden premises, point out when there's a logical fallacy, and then use something called the Socratic method. And this will bring us to D. I want to give you a little primer on the Socratic method. I don't think I'm going to be a very good teacher of this. This is going to take a little bit of time to do. This is going to take kind of the bulk of today's talk. But I want you to learn it as best you can. It's going to be a little complex at first, but I'm going to try to simplify it. And then I'm going to call on Jonah, our philosophy teacher, to come and tell me where I was wrong and how to simplify it better. And he may say, you did a good job, and he's doing that either out of humility, but I told him he's not allowed to do that. If he thinks I'm wrong or it could be explained better, he's going out of obedience to come up here and explain it better. I was going to just tell him to come explain it for you while I sat down, but I'm not going to do that. That's going to seem a little lazy. And I have my pride to take care of that I'm telling you to get rid of. Okay, we talked about how this is not about being right. If it's not about being right, what is it about? It's about helping people come to the truth. Which means it's about coming to the truth together. The focus is on coming to a common understanding, not about beating them. If you have the sense in a discussion, whether about the faith or the modern culture, that your goal is to beat the other person, you've already lost because you have the wrong disposition. That's not the goal. This is not debate club. Debate club, by the way, is one of the best places to find logical fallacies. When I took my class in college about about spotting logical fallacies and understanding them. The professor said that the first year he taught it, he forgot to give a warning not to use these things against your opponents. And he had a guy who was in debate club, And he came and reported back after this big debate meet that they had. And he goes, "How'd you do?" And he goes, "Oh, I won." He goes, "That's great." And he goes, "Well, it's not so great." And he goes, "Why isn't it great?" And he goes, "Well, after you taught us about all these logical fallacies, I decided to use them all against my opponent, and it worked." And he was like, so from then on, he learned to warn his class, don't use these to beat your opponent. This is not what it's about. Really, what is this about ultimately? Even when we're talking about things in the culture, ultimately, our final goal should be to prepare their hearts to receive Christ. Are you going to convince them about Christ and orthodoxy right then and there? No! No. But what you can do is open their heart enough to plant some seeds. That's what you want to do. It's not about beating them. It's not about humiliating them. It's about planting some seeds, and hopefully those seeds are for Christ. That's the ultimate goal. So what is the Socratic method? The Socratic method is where you use cooperative, it's a cooperative argumentative method. When I say argumentative, I don't mean that you're arguing and fighting. I just mean that you're going off of two different points, two different positions. But it's a cooperation, a cooperative argumentative method in which we seek to stimulate critical thinking. In other words, to help the other person think through the issue by drawing out and examining the underlying premises or presuppositions through the asking of questions. It's a nice, I told you we're going to go complex to simpler. What you're really doing is you're trying to find out the unexamined premises or presuppositions that they're using, and through asking them questions rather than challenging, through asking them questions, you're helping them to look more deeply at those premises and to see where there are internal contradictions. So, there's a 10-point method, and I'm going to simplify this to just 4 points at the end, so you don't need to write all these down if you don't want to, but there's basically 10 points that you'd normally go through. Some of these can be intermixed, and some you can kind of skip, but basically there's 10 points. Number one, you start with a place of agreement, or in the case of some people, flattery. Mm-hmm. Flattery basically means, I'm so glad that you care, like we can talk about Black Lives Matter, I'm so glad you care about justice, I'm so glad you're passionate about it. It's really wonderful. It's just a great way to start off so that you calm things down to begin with, right? We want a calm spirit so that people are actually open. Two, you share what you believe. This is what I believe. Share what you believe. This is what I believe about this. Number three, ask them what they believe. I understand you think I'm wrong. Tell me about it. Tell me what you believe. Four, if necessary, ask them to expand. You're probably going to have to. Because again, we talk past each other and we use terms and we think that people understand what we're saying and they understand what we're saying. It doesn't really work that way. We have to ask them to expand a little bit. Number five, listen very closely and don't interrupt, which is a very, very big temptation for us to interrupt. Don't interrupt. Listen closely. Number six, locate the faulty premise and then restate their position using that premise. Number seven, ask questions to investigate that faulty premise. Well, wait a minute, you said this. Tell me more about that. What about this? Number eight, help them to see for themselves the inconsistency of their position. If they discover the inconsistency, rather than you just point it out, they're much more open to changing that. If you just point it out, they're going to dig in. But if they discover it for themselves, it's a very useful tactic. Number nine, reasonably ask them to look at your perspective, to accept your premise. This is the premise you used. This is what was behind what you believe. But what about this? And then show them the conclusion of your premise. This is where it would lead to. Okay. So, again, kind of complex. I'm going to give you an example from the one whose name this comes from. Socrates. Socrates is where we got the Socratic method. And he had a conversation. There's a book you can get. And I'm going to say the name wrong. Euthyphro. There's a conversation that he had with Euthyphro. And I'm going to oversimplify this a lot, by the way. It gets really complex. I'm going to oversimplify this. I'm going to drive Jonah mad right now. He's not going to have any hair on the sides of his head by the time I'm done with this. Too bad. Deal with it. So, Euthyphro, he wants to prosecute his own father because he says that it's the godly thing to do. This is the righteous thing to do. And so, Socrates comes along and challenges him on this. And listen to the Socratic method. Remember, number one, start with a place of agreement or flattery. Socrates compliments Euthyphro on his aim of living a godly life. That's where he starts. You believe in godliness and you want to live a godly life? That's great. That's awesome. I really respect you for that. Number two, share what you believe. Now, Socrates didn't do this in this case. He didn't share what he believed, except that he believed in seeking truth and godliness. That's basically what he said. I believe in seeking truth and godliness too. And so he asks Euthyphro to do something. He asks him to be his teacher. Pretty smart. If you know about godliness, I want to learn from you. You must be the master of this. Please, tell me about godliness. So that's number three. Ask them what they believe. He asked Euthyphro what godliness and ungodliness are. Tell me. Define these things for me. Tell me their nature. Four, if necessary, ask them to expand. So Socrates listens really closely to Euthyphro, but Euthyphro doesn't answer the question. What he does is he gives an example of what he considers godliness to be, but he doesn't actually discuss its nature. So five, listen closely, don't interrupt. Socrates waits. He waits until he's done, and then he asks the question again. He tells him, well, you gave me an example, but we're talking about the nature of godliness, so can you tell me what that is? And Euthyphro says that godliness, what's holy, is whatever is dear to the gods. That's his answer. Whatever is dear to the gods, that's godliness. Six, locate the faulty premise and restate their position. So Socrates restates Euthyphro's position, but he makes the hidden premise a little bit clearer. He goes, basically what you're saying, I'm paraphrasing here, basically what you're saying is that whatever is dear to the gods is holy, and whatever is hateful to the gods is unholy. So things that are holy and unholy are the opposites of one another. Is that right? And Euthyphro goes, yep, that's right. That's basically what I'm saying. Number seven, ask questions to investigate that faulty premise. So Socrates then asks Euthyphro to expand on this. He asks him to expand about the nature of the gods, and he asks them if they sometimes argue and have enmity between them. And Euthyphro goes, yeah, sometimes the gods disagree and they have a little bit of anger and enmity between them. So now number eight, help them to see for themselves the inconsistency of their position. So now Socrates gently notes that there's a big inconsistency. If the gods, he argues, disagree with one another, some things that are hated by some gods are actually loved by other gods. So some things are both godly and ungodly at the same time. And Euthyphro understands that his premise is not very strong. Number nine, reasonably ask them to look at your perspective and to accept your premise. So Socrates has now gently opened Euthyphro's mind to a new idea. And this dialogue continues. Socrates keeps asking more and more questions about what the nature of godliness is then. It's kind of humorous, by the way. In this dialogue, Euthyphro gets really angry that Socrates is going around in circles with his logic. And Socrates, he responds, he goes, well, with my logic, I've only been asking you questions. If anyone's logic is going around in circles, it must be yours. It's pretty smart. 10, show them the conclusion of your premise. Well, Socrates doesn't actually explain his conclusion because Euthyphro, he gets really mad and leaves in a lot of anger and embarrassment. But in a way, did he learn Socrates' point? In a way, because he learned to be a little bit more cautious with what he claims truth is. And Socrates' main goal was to really help people learn how to think. So that's where we get the Socratic method from. Are you pulling your hair out? Was that terrible? All right, pretty good. All right, I'll take it pretty good. Come and say here so we can hear in the mic. Mm-hmm.
Well, just one thing is, notice that in that Euthyphro example, or I guess we didn't really get to this part, but it ends actually with a huge dilemma. It's called the Euthyphro dilemma, which I won't go over what that is, but it ends with a big question mark. So maybe one thing to say is just that this method, the Socratic method, doesn't, in fact, usually it ends with question marks. It doesn't end with some sort of position you wanted to put in place of the problematic position. It's not really a strategy that Socrates uses to try to argue for a position so much as to show someone sort of what follows problematically from the things that they buy into. And then the other thing is, Euthyphro is a good example of this point too, that you don't always start with necessarily agreement, But you start. In fact, you might start with a point. Like you said, you find the premise that you're going to end up showing is problematic, and so it can be. You might start with something that you actually strongly disagree with. I guess that's a case maybe where you would say it's more like the flattery case, because he does start with flattery with Euthyphro,
right.
But very much the initial premise that they follow the consequences of is something that Socrates certainly doesn't agree with. But that's kind of an important point too, I think, because you might think, well, I have to find something I agree with this person if I'm going to use the Socratic method to reason with them. No, you can start with something you totally disagree with, and in fact, that's what you have to look for. I think it was in step two or whatever. Look for that premise that you want to question. Agreement's not necessary. But.
Perfect. Thank you. That's why we have you here, Jonah.
So that first point I especially want to touch on in just a second, because there's a quote I wanted to give you, and I forgot to write it down, so thank you. That was providential, because it's a really great, great quote. But I do want to say, do you notice if you use this method, first of all, does this give you many opportunities to get really angry? You have to have your mind pretty sharp to be able to do this. How sharp is your mind going to be if you have steam coming out of your ears? Not very. And also, this is a very slow and steady method. It's a slow, which actually helps you be a little bit calm. But that first point is really, really important, that you may not come to a conclusion. You may just point out something that leaves some questions. You may have them just question. One of the greatest quotes about talking about your faith comes from St. Paisios. It's one of my favorite quotes from St. Paisios. It's so awesome. St. Paisios says, your goal isn't to convince everybody. Your goal is to leave them with a holy sense of discomfort. Awesome. Such an awesome quote. Leave them with a holy sense of discomfort. In other words, leave them at a point where they go, maybe I need to learn about this. You leave their heart open. If your job is just to beat them, you're going to close them up. But if you use this method, you open them up. You open them up to wanting to discover more. And that's where that experience of faith, where you can tell them that and say, this is what happens in our faith. It's really important. So I want to simplify this into four simple things. Okay, these are the ones to write down. Four simple points. Number one, find out what they believe. Number two, ask questions about underlying premises. Number three, help them to see the inconsistencies in their own logic. And number four, if four is optional, when ready, if it's possible and beneficial, present a better option. That's when you can present a better option. Okay, that's really the Socratic method. Boiled down to 4 points, I think, kind of. I got a nod from Jonah. All right, I'm doing good. Give me a grade. How am I doing so far?
A+.
All right. I don't know what those look like, but no. All right, let's keep going. We're doing okay on time. Not perfect, but we're doing okay. E, here's a big question a lot of you have. When should we engage? When should we have these discussions? We need to gauge the situation. We can't just jump right in. In the middle of a riot, is that a good time to have a discussion? In most cases, probably not. But I will tell you, I actually did when we had the riots out here. I had some good discussions, only with a couple people. One of them was when the riots were over. One was in the middle of it, but they weren't in the middle of the chaos. And there wasn't too much chaos happening at that point. It was a decent discussion for what it was. But there are different situations. I'm going to give you three things that you need to look for. Number one, what if the person is just a pure ideologue? What if they're just completely hostile? The truth is, you won't know this until you engage them in the discussion. Some people look like they're hostile and ideologues until you have this discussion, and they can actually calm down and have a real conversation. I've seen it happen. It's like miraculous when it does. But if you really sit with them with love and humility, and they feel that you love them and care about them, and you are actually interested in them, you can actually get a calm response, and you can take somebody who is initially like an ideologue and actually get them out of that mode. Because we're too used to that. We're too used to being in that mode. That's the way we discuss things in our culture today, right? I think this. Well, I think this! And you just go for it, right? And I always give the same example. Like, we do this about movies. We do this about... It's so dumb. This was a great movie. No, it was a terrible movie! Why are we getting so angry about this? I mean, the only time I understand it is when we're talking about Star Wars The Last Jedi, which was a terrible movie. I don't know why you could possibly like it. You're wrong if you liked it. This is terrible. It's awful. But beyond that, this is actually how we get. I've had that conversation with the Havens kids. They're like, it was great. I'm like, no, it was terrible. And we get into this nice little fight about it. But if you'll notice if somebody is just completely dug in and they're a complete ideologue. They'll use a lot of the red herrings. They'll use a lot of these other logical fallacies, and you can't calm them down, and they start attacking you. At that point, there's nothing to do. There's nothing to do, at least directly. Don't get offended. This is part of humility. You need to work on this. You need to practice this. Don't get offended. Don't engage. Just agree to disagree and walk away. That's what you need to do at those moments when you're really dealing with an ideologue. And then what do? You go pray for them. Go pray. Pray from the depths of your heart for that person that they can open up. But if their heart is already closed off and they refuse to open it, there's nothing you can do about that. And they may use it to attack you. Don't get angry. You know what the fathers say about that? They say that person is the one who's being attacked, not you. It may sound like they're attacking you, but really, the demons are attacking them. And so we need to pray for them. Proverbs 23:9. Do not speak in the hearing of a fool. If a fool can listen, don't speak. For he will despise the good sense of your words. Don't throw a pearl before swine. There's some people it's better just to keep it to yourself, walk away. Okay? Second type of person. The person who's just, they're not angry about what you have to say and what you believe. They're just disinterested. They just don't care. This is actually a little bit more dangerous sometimes. This is why, one of the reasons in Revelation it says that the Lord would rather have you be hot or cold, but the lukewarm he'll spew out of his mouth. Why? Because when you're lukewarm, even if you hear the right arguments, you don't even care. But if you're angry, if you're hot and angry, at least when you're fighting God, you're actually in a conversation with God somewhat. And sometimes something will happen where it'll just click. It's awesome when that happens, by the way, if you've ever seen somebody just in a heated discussion and then suddenly something clicks and they go, oh. And suddenly it's like their whole world is shaken. But they start to open up a little bit. So disinterested can actually be more dangerous. It's not always, though, because sometimes you can actually spark interest in people. But the main way you're going to do that, you can try talking to them. You can try telling them about the glory of your faith. But really the best thing you can do is just live the life. Be silent in words, but let your life speak. Let them see the peace and the joy that you have no matter what's happening around you. Let them see you face tribulation with peace and hope and trust in God. And eventually they may go, I'm not that way. I'm plagued by anxiety. I want to be more like that. It's the best thing you can do. The third type of person, you have the ideologues, those who are hostile, those who are disinterested, and the third, the person who's actually open and may want to learn or at least discuss it. This is where you can speak from reason and logic, but you want to speak even more from experience. Speak more from experience. There's reason, use an experience. The saints is a good example of this. This is one of the main things. When I talk to somebody about the faith, I talk about the saints. I tell them. The example, you've probably heard this before. The example I use all the time. Imagine that you wanted to become the best brain surgeon there ever was, and you had a choice between two schools. University A had created some of the most famous brain surgeons. They were experts in their fields. They were in, you know, every periodical imaginable. They were all published. They had created new methods that were known around the world and named after them. And the second university has a bunch of people who were sued for malpractice, has a bunch of people who lost patients on the table more than they saved people. Which university would you want to go to? Obviously the first one. This is the argument I give for Orthodoxy all the time. Look at the success stories. When you want to look at a faith, look at the ones who have actually graduated in a sense. Look to the saints. When you look at our saints, these are the answers to what can this faith do for you? And if you can't find figures like this in another form of Christianity or another faith, that tells you something. What are we producing? We're producing modern saints whose relics have fragrant myrrh streaming from them, who have miracles literally happening daily at their relics, who continue to appear to people after they've died. We have people who have clearly conquered the devil, conquered death, conquered corruption. It's a pretty big witness. By the way, I wrote a booklet about this very topic. So many people ask me when they see me dressed as a priest, they go, what's Orthodoxy? Again, I can't sell Girl Scout cookies and pretend it's Orthodoxy. It's really hard to explain what Orthodoxy is in a short moment. So I usually tell them, well, most of these churches that you read about in the New Testament, if you look at them today, they have Orthodox bishops. And if you go to Antioch or you go to Galatia, you go to any of these places, you're going to find Orthodox bishops and you can find a continuous line. And that's my little two-sentence summary. But if I really want to explain Orthodoxy, I give very little history and I talk about the saints. And so I have a booklet that a few people are reading right now. They're going to give me their feedback, and I'm hoping to get it published by the end of the year. And it's just a simple explanation of what is orthodoxy. And my goal is that it's short enough that if somebody asks you that, you don't have the time to explain, you just hand them this booklet. You know, everyone has a few. That'll really increase sales, by the way, if every Orthodox Christian has three or four in their pocket. But it's just like a 50-page explanation of, like, at its root, what is this really about? This is about conquering death, the devil, corruption, disease, illness. And this is the proof of it. That's the argument I use. Ultimately, it goes to the saints. Now, what happens? I told you there's times when you just need to walk away. We talked about when you're talking with an ideologue. When Christ or the Theotokos or the saints are mocked and dishonored, you need to gauge the situation again. There is no point in arguing, but at times a rebuke is necessary. We, as Orthodox Christians, do not allow our ears to hear blasphemy. And if it's the right situation, like with family, we say so. I will not listen to that. The conversation's over. At other times, we humbly just walk away. You just remain silent and walk away. I'll give you a couple of examples of this. I saw a guy in an airport once. He was walking in front of me, and he had a book in his hand, and he dropped the book right next to a garbage can. It hit the rim and fell out. And I was like, you know me, I'm a bibliophile. I love my books. And so I was like, oh, thank God it didn't go in the garbage can. You can't do that to books. So then he picked it up off the ground and he threw it almost angrily into the trash can. And I went, oh, different situation. So I said behind him, I said, not a very good read, huh? You know what he told me? He said, on page 2, this book blasphemed my Lord and Savior. I will not read another word. And he threw it out. Awesome. Awesome. Can you imagine if we acted that way with our movies and television? It's the way we should. But I'll give you another example. There's a book about this nun named Mother Gabriella. And there's a story in there where she's on a train with somebody. Or a train or a bus, I forget. I think it was a train. And she was talking with somebody who recognized her as an Orthodox nun and started mocking the faith and saying how, I don't know if the person was Protestant or what, but they started kind of blaspheming the Theotokos. Mother Gabriella didn't say a word, but at the next stop, she immediately got up and just quietly walked off. About 5 minutes later, the person caught up with her and said, I could tell you were upset and you left because of me. It's because of what I said. Please forgive me. I'm so sorry. Which is a pretty powerful witness. There are times when that's the necessary response. Just get up, walk away. The best words to use? Come and see. Come and see are our best words. Prayer is our best response. Come and see are our best words. By the way, we should keep a list of people to pray for. It's in the back of our parish prayer book where you can write the names of living. You should keep a list of people, especially when you notice that they're just completely against the faith. They're hostile to it. They don't even want to look into it. Pray for them. Pray for them. And it may take years of prayer, but in heaven, won't that be worth it? When you're standing at the judgment seat and you see somebody standing on the right side because you prayed for them for decades, is that not worth it? It's worth it. It's worth our time. By the way, what's the best way to pray for people? It's really hard to pray for a lot of people every single day. The best way, create a list. Go through the list. Just read all the names and then say, Lord, may this prayer be for all of them. Keep them in your heart and just pray the Jesus prayer. Just like Norma. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. And most holy Theotokos, save us. That's what St. Porphyrio says. He goes, we're all connected anyway. You don't need to say, have mercy on them. They're connected to you. So keep them in your heart. Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. We should be doing that every single day. Every single one of us. How powerful would that be? I think if I step forward, the sun's still going to be my eye. So I'm just going to keep going with this. Okay, finally F. We're almost there. We almost made it. Some advice for specific scenarios. I want to talk to you about what to do in your work situation. Tough. It's tough. A lot of places are now requiring employees to wear pride buttons or go in the pride parade to support transgenderism, to wear Black Lives Matter gear, things like that. So what do we do? Practical piece of advice, you need to be smart. If you're in a business like this, you need to ask for performance reviews periodically, at least once a year. You need to ask for performance review and get them to give it to you in writing. Because if you're fired for your faith, they're going to come up with a different reason for it, right? If you have the performance review and say, well, wait a minute, you didn't bring any of this up and none of this was brought to my attention ever. That's in your defense. You need to have performance reviews. You cannot, I repeat, you cannot participate in this stuff, even if it means you're going to get fired. Hopefully you have a religious rights case that you can then sue the company for, because that's the reality of our country. You're not supposed to be discriminated for your faith. But you cannot kowtow to it. You cannot say, well, I'll walk in the pride parade, but I won't wave a flag. I'll just be silent. No. No. Your faith comes first. Christ comes first. You do not participate in this stuff. You don't wear the buttons. You don't wear the shirts. Period. Even if it means you're going to be mocked at work. Who cares? They mocked, spat upon, and crucified Christ. If we're spat upon, it's to our honor. If you notice that they're pushing for you to be part of this stuff, talk to your superiors privately. Don't make a big hubbub about this. Go talk to them privately. You start there. The good thing is you're at a little bit of an advantage in Utah because they tend to be a little bit more traditionally minded when it comes to morality, but not as much as you might think. I've had a lot of people come to me and tell me about their situations and how tough they are. Avoid discussions with coworkers. You don't need to be discussing this stuff. This isn't the place to do it. If you're pushed, though, if you're pushed and you find it necessary to talk about this, humbly speak. Humbly speak. Speak with a lot of humility and love. And it's best just simply to say, I have a different perspective, but I'd be happy to discuss this with you in private outside of work hours. If they're going to push you, that's the way to do it. Tell them you'll discuss it outside of work hours, privately. And most importantly, know who you're talking to. Because if it's somebody who's going to cause you problems, just simply say, forget it. Forget it. Finally, have no fear. If you're fired for standing for the truth, God will honor you for that. It's to your benefit. Have no fear. Don't think that you'll be lost. Don't think that you'll be completely destitute. God will take care of you. Have faith. Have faith. And let that faith really bolster you so that you have no fear. Okay, what about family? Obviously, live the life as much as possible. Live your faith. Try to anticipate issues. If you have an aunt coming over who you know is especially hostile to your viewpoints, anticipate it. And decide ahead of time how you're going to deal with it. Am I going to engage or not? You have to gauge the situation. We should also do this in cases like Thanksgiving and fasting. People say this all the time. They go, well, my family will be really upset if I don't eat. Well, if you told them you're a vegetarian, would they be mad that you don't eat turkey? Probably not. But because it's about the faith, they get upset. So tell them ahead of time, way ahead of time, and say, like, I realize you're making the meal, so don't worry about me so much. I'm going to have some things. I'm not going to have everything. Please don't get offended. This is just my faith. Prepare them ahead of time. Anticipate these issues. If arguments ensue, and it really becomes an argument, not a discussion, the best thing to do is just look at them, say, I love you. I don't want to discuss this anymore because I don't want there to be enmity between us, and walk away. You need to be ready to do that, even if it means they're going to hold on to it. If they're going to hold on to it, it's their problem. Don't let their problem become your problem. I had a priest who kind of mentored me in my last parish. He always used to tell me, don't wrestle with a pig. It only gets you dirty and the pig loves it. It's a good saying. If somebody just loves to argue, they can love to argue, but you're not going to participate in it. Pray a lot for your family. Every day pray for your family. It's the most powerful thing you have. I tell people all the time, when my kids are really acting out, I know what the problem is. I haven't been praying enough. I can tell them what to do right or what they're doing wrong. I could give them every punishment in the book. But if I spend 2-3 nights really praying for them, their bad behavior disappears. It's my fault. Pray for them. It really works. If they ask, be gentle and loving. And again, talk experience. Experience is really powerful, especially with family members, when you tell them what this faith has done. And finally, yes, there are times to be bold. Even if it means it's going to create a little bit of a squabble. Doesn't matter. I had this situation recently with one of my family members where they didn't want to talk to somebody else in the family about what they were doing wrong. And I said, you know what? Stop protecting yourself. This is for their salvation. They need to hear these words. You need to lovingly talk to them about this. Sometimes we need to be bold and we need to stand up for Christ. And sometimes that's about planting those seeds. Friends. You can't be friends with everybody. Sorry, you can't be friends with everybody. A lot of Orthodox Christians try. They say, well, I'm just going to keep being friends with certain people. there are certain people you just can't be friends with. If they know, if knowing what you believe causes you not to be their friend anymore, because they just can't stand you, so be it. So be it. Christ wasn't friendly with everybody. He wasn't friends with everybody. He was closer with some than others, and some people he wasn't close to at all by their choice. We need to stand for our faith first. It doesn't mean you slap him in the face with it. But you need to know. You need to know if this is a situation where we just simply can't continue this friendship. Christ comes first. Christ comes first. This means no Saturday night parties. Sorry. No Saturday night parties. You're preparing for communion the next day. You're preparing for liturgy. No doing harmful things for fun. No bachelor parties, obviously, where there's craziness going on. You need to watch out. Especially, you know, it's funny how the devil has worked this out. What are the two party days? Fridays and Saturdays. Friday is the day that we fast, commemorating Christ's crucifixion. Saturday, we prepare for liturgy on Sunday. It's kind of sad that those two nights have been so taken by the devil. Been so taken. Again, obviously, same advice, pray. Pray for your friends. Pray for them. And know how to gauge the conversations that you're going to have with them if you're going to have them. Know when to speak, when not to speak. Know how to speak. Use the methods that we talked about tonight. Keep in mind, especially with friends, this is not just with friends, even family, coworkers, this is not equal footing territory. What I mean by that is it's not like a, well, I believe this and you believe that and let's all just, that's fine. No. No. You can't do that, because what happens is that becomes practical and you say, well, I'll tell you what, I'll go to your service if you come to mind. Can't do that. We need to stand for the faith to be able to say, I can't go to your service. The church is the bride of the bridegroom. I'm in this marriage with the church. I'm connected to Christ. When I was baptized, I'm connected to him. And because of that, I can't commit adultery with him. I can't go to your service. I'm sorry. We need to say, this is truth. Whether we agree or not, I know what truth is. This is truth. We can disagree, but I'm not going to say that your beliefs are equal to mine. Doesn't mean you attack them again. Last thing, what about, a lot of people ask, what do we do if we're asked to pray? Or we're at a friend's house or with family who are non-Orthodox. What do we do about prayers? Well, if they ask you to say the prayer, by all means, say the prayer. If they say the prayer, what I always do is I keep my head lower, my eyes closed, and I just do the Jesus prayer while they pray. Because we can't pray with them in the same sense anymore. We can't. Because that's an act of communion, and they're praying to a God that's not our God. How do we share in a prayer if we're not even aiming those prayers in the same place? There's not the same beliefs. So we have to be cautious about those things. You know what I found, though? For most people, they don't get offended with these things. If you tell them, and you tell them gently with a lot of love, they actually respect it. They go, boy, you're really committed. You're principled on this. I disagree, but I respect it. Most people. One last quote for you. 1 Peter 4:14. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. When you're talking about the faith, you may be attacked for it, you may be rebuked, you may be insulted, you may be hated. According to St. Peter, in God's love letter to us, the Scriptures, we're blessed. We're blessed. So have no fear. Trust in the Lord. Plant the seeds when you can. When you can't, walk away and base everything in prayer. So I went a little bit over. Forgive me. But thank you so much. Hopefully that was practical enough, and at least most of it was simple enough that you feel like you benefited from that and know a little bit more about how to engage with the culture around us.